Coach, he scores!
Into the Leafs Nation podcast. I'm here, JB Nakoda, and with me is Adam, otherwise known as Drag Like Pull on Twitter and Pension Play Puppets. How's it going?
Not too bad. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks. Apart from the lack of hockey, I mean, really all that's left to discuss is how long the lockout is going to go. I think we can agree that the lockout is going to happen. We're not going to see hockey until at least January. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't see anything. I don't see the season starting on time. Everyone is saying that January is the deadline, mostly on account of the Winter Classic and the NHL not wanting to lose the publicity and all that sort of thing. And that seems kind of reasonable, but there hasn't really been anyone inside the negotiations who said anything like that. And I kind of feel like that's a bit of speculation that we're, everyone kind of believes that that's true, but I kind of wonder if it is.
That's true. I was talking with at Driving Play on Twitter, and he was saying, you know what, I really think that the owners still hold the upper hand. I think they're going to lock the players out, and they're just going to wait until, you know, players run out of savings, and then, you know, the players are just fold, and it'll be exactly like the last lockout. Do you see things going that way as well?
I don't know if it's quite like that. I don't know that there's quite as much urgency on the NHL's part this time. I agree that they have pretty much all of the leverage here, but the last time it was very much they were just going to wait until the players would agree to a salary cap, right?
Yeah.
And the players wouldn't agree to that until basically the whole year had been lost. I think this time the issues are a bit less contentious. Obviously, the league wants to cut the player share of revenue way more than they're interested in doing.
Sure.
But a lot of it's just haggling over numbers for the most part now. It's not a gigantic systemic change like last time. And so I think they're not just going to literally wait until the players, you know, accept their first offer, but I think they are going to wait out until the players give up a lot more than they've offered so far.
I think it was you that described it as, the NHL's side of things anyway, is more about gaining control rather than a gain in revenue. Do you want to expand on that?
Revenue is independent of the CBA, right? It's based on TV ratings. It's based on, they have a big TV deal in the U.S. I believe the deal in Canada is coming up for negotiation in another year or two.
So you obviously, mean CBC?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's obviously potentially a lot of money on the table there, especially with CTV potentially getting in this time.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article in McLean's not too long ago, and apparently CTV was not in on the negotiations last time, and that sort of gave CBC a lot of leverage in the negotiations. And I would not be surprised if CTV tried to get in this time. So I think there's some room for the NHL to increase revenues there.
I've been in contact with some people from CBC, and I actually asked them about their viewership for at least the Eastern time zone, the 7 o'clock CBC starts. And it has gone steadily upwards for the last three or four years. So, just as a side note, CBC has been doing very, very well for themselves, despite the fact that, I mean, to be honest with you, the on-air talent is, I mean, it's awful. I mean, Mike Milbury, Glenn Healy, they could stand to lose easily four or five guys off that on-air talent team, talent being in quotation marks.
Yeah, well, I certainly miss the days where it was LeBrun and DeHatchick on the hot stove rather than Milbury and Francis, for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. I could stand to see a lot more Elliot Friedman. I mean, God willing, one day James Myrtle. There are a few guys on there that I would love to see remain on CBC for a long time. I mean, Ron McLean, I still think, is probably one of the only people in the business with the gonads to really go at Gary Bettman. But anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that CBC continues to be a really relevant and pretty strong broadcasting team, despite the few, talking heads that give it a bad name.
For sure. But so to get back to like this, the CBA and revenue and that kind of thing. So as I said in my piece, when I look at sort of the specific demands that got leaked, and we don't know how much of this, what the NHL proposed actually got leaked. There might be all sorts of stuff that,
right,
you know, what we've heard has probably been leaked by the PA, given that it came from Larry Brooks. So it's sort of what the PA wants us to hear, right?
Right, yeah.
But based on what's come out, most of the proposals don't really help the small market teams in any way. And they certainly don't help them generate more revenue, which is the problem that they have right now. But it looks like the NHL basically is trying to structure the CBA so that teams have more control over players for longer, which is interesting with a set percent of hockey revenue going to the players because they still have to spend that money. So it's almost like the NHL wants to go back to the era where 31, 32-year-old unrestricted free agents got like, you know, $8, $9 million deals that they weren't really worth, and the younger guys, you know, who were worth a lot of money weren't making really very much. It's kind of a weird shift that they're looking at.
Yeah, really. I mean, you know, and the other thing is, and I don't think a lot of people realize this, but it wasn't that long ago that the NHL really didn't have much in the way of free agency, right? I mean, it was only about 20 years ago that teams just basically had the rights to the players for pretty much their entire career, you know, until they were traded or whatever. It really only began with the Gretzky trade. Somebody, you know, sort of sat up and said, wait a minute, you traded for Gretzky and, you know, you gave up all of these players and $15 million. Wait a minute, maybe we're worth more than we really realize here.
It's kind of funny if you think about, you know, during the Pat Quinn era, the Leafs were, you know, people would say, oh, sure, the Leafs signed McGillney and the Leafs signed Roberts, but they're signing all these guys who are past their primes. The Leafs can't get anyone during their best years. They get McGillney when he's on the downswing and that sort of thing. So it's funny how free agency has switched in that way, and that, you know, you sign Parise or Suter right now and, you know, you're getting a really great player at the peak of his talents.
Yeah, it's true, eh? Yeah, no, and that really didn't come to the front until, or that didn't really start until, 1995? Or was that actually, come to think of it, actually, no, one of the great victories for the PA in the last lockout was the fact that, yeah, the free agency started a bit earlier.
Yeah, for sure, and I wasn't surprised at all, actually, to see the owners go after that, because I think that's... One of the things that's driven up salaries on the so-called second contract is that the second contract pretty much leads to unrestricted free agency now, right?
Yeah.
So you're almost paying UFA prices or something similar, especially if you're buying out UFA years. And so I wasn't at all surprised to see the teams going after that, because I think part of the thing that they're thinking is if they can put off free agency until 28, 29, whatever, the second contracts will go down because the players won't be, you know...
Sure.
The players will get a second contract, and then they'll have another RFA contract before they hit unrestricted.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that's part of it, especially when you look at like guys like Drew Doughty or Steven Stamkos who are hitting UFA at 25 right now because of the seven-year rule. Like, it was pretty obvious that the GMs were going to go after that. Just looking at the stuff that's in the CBA, I don't really see anything that's going to make the small market teams more stable, and I'm not really sure that it's going to make them much more competitive either, because a lot of the changes help the big market teams just as much.
Yeah. One of the things I think would be interesting to watch is the Edmonton Oilers and how they deal with their cap situation, because, you know, I think we saw a lot of post-2004-5 lockout teams. They had all these guys on ELCs. They came up through the ranks. It was great. They were able to afford a highly talented team because they had a bunch of guys outperforming their contracts. And then all of a sudden, they had to pay them their secondary contracts, and it became way too expensive to actually, you know, field a decent club. So then, you know, you saw a few teams bleed good players. Not all of them, but, you know, a few of them, definitely. Chicago is probably the best recent example. But yeah, it was difficult to get that second contract for a decent value. Now I feel it's come back a little bit the other way. And Burke, I have to give him credit. He's, you know, if he's done one thing right, is to negotiate pretty good, expired RFA contracts. And it'll be interesting to see what a team like the Edmonton Oilers manages to do with the coming, you know, new collective bargaining agreement. Because, of course, they're going to have a ton of ELCs, or entry-level contracts, expiring. And if the NHL manages to push the free agency age up a bit, they may actually be able to afford a few of these players for longer than just, you know, a few years.
Yeah, although it'll be interesting to see how the Taylor Hall contract sort of sets the bar for where other Edmonton players sign, because Eberle is probably going to come in somewhere in that range. You know, Nugent Hopkins, if he can play something like he played last year, you know, he might be in that range. You might get Yakupov in that range. So even if the rules change, there's always an inter-team dynamic, right? You know, there used to be the rule on the Devils that no one made more than Brodeur, and there was the rule on the Red Wings that no one made more than Lidstrom, and that kind of thing. So you might get a situation in Edmonton where the CBA, you know, makes it easier to keep a guy like Ryan Nugent-Hopkins under contract, but because the Taylor Hall contract has set a precedent, you can't pay Nugent Hopkins $3 million now because he'll be making half as much as Taylor Hall.
But, sure.
You know, putting the same output, like his agent's not going to be very happy about that, right?
Yeah, I'll be curious to see if there's another rollback in salary, you know, that comes with this next CBA. I mean, it'd be pretty ridiculous if there was, to be honest with you. I mean, can you imagine a business in the real world that required employees en masse to just take less money than they were, you know, twice within a decade? If you know of a situation where this occurred, I mean, I'll step off, but...
I think you do occasionally when a company is, you know, close to going out of business or something. You know, you see workers who will, they'll negotiate a CBA and they'll accept some kind of lesser wages, but usually there's some kind of trade-off.
Yeah.
And the NHL obviously is not proposing any kind of trade-off. It's just, we want 24% of the money back, which I think is pretty unprecedented.
Here's another thought for you. In the past few weeks, we've seen three teams throw around some pretty serious money. The Philadelphia Flyers, of course, have thrown incredible money at Shea Weber. And then we have the Oilers signing Hall to a not insignificant deal. I mean, you know, it was a fair deal. It's what I would expect him to earn. But at the same time, you know, the Oilers can't cry poor after signing a deal like that. And then, of course, Mr. Pegula is providing his Darcy Regier with all kinds of money to spend on players that really the Sabres couldn't afford otherwise. That is, they're offering Shane Doan an obscene amount of money. And, I mean, I have to think that other NHL owners are not thrilled with the idea that the Sabres are willing to inflate player value at that, you know, at that level. And, you know, between these three teams, you know, because we basically have a rich team in the Flyers, a mid-range team in the Oilers, and sort of a poorer team in Buffalo, making pretty serious contract commitments in the last week, or, well, a couple weeks anyway. You have to think that this sort of undermines the league's position that they really need to bring down player salaries in order to pad their revenue.
Yeah, well, I think, like, if you look at Edmonton specifically, Taylor Hall is their own player. He's sort of the face of the franchise. I think they kind of have to sign him to a big deal.
Absolutely.
But when you look at what, you know, Buffalo and Philadelphia are doing, we're talking about free agents, right? We're talking about Shea Weber. We're talking about Shane Doan. We're talking about Ville Leino, which I'm sure Buffalo would rather we didn't. So I think there's a bit of a different situation there in that Edmonton for a long time has been a team that kind of would raise up players and then trade them when they got good and needed money, right? Before the salary cap. So yeah. I think, you know, as a franchise, it's really important for them to be able to hold on to these guys now. But when you talk about throwing $7.5 million a year at what, Shane Doan, 35 years old?
Yeah. Like, what is he, a 50 point player? Maybe?
Yeah. Like, I think Shane Doan is a valuable player. I think he's still a good, legitimate top six forward, but he's, sure, you know, he's not Zach Parise at this point in his career.
Absolutely not.
And so I wonder in cases like that, I wonder how much ownership is involved, because it sounds like, you know, basically Pegula comes in and Darcy Regier starts making moves that he never would have made,
sure,
when Pegula wasn't in charge, right? He wasn't going after big name unrestricted free agents before. Obviously, the money situation was a bit different, you know.
And we know in Philadelphia's case that Ed Snyder was absolutely involved in signing Ilya Bryzgalov. And, you know, he absolutely told Holmgren, look, clear the deck, do what you have to do, we need this goalie. And we know he was involved in the offer for Shea Weber. So, I mean, you know, you've got to think that, you know, that's not an isolated case.
Yeah, so, and I think also in Calgary, I very strongly suspect that ownership is telling Jay Feaster he can't rebuild. Because the impression I got from Feaster sort of when he first came aboard was that he wanted to make some moves. But I don't think ownership in Calgary will let them get rid of Iginla or Kiprasov or any of those players, because I think they want to put out the sort of the impression that they're a team that thinks it can make the playoffs every year.
You're giving Feaster a lot of credit here.
Perhaps. But when you talk about, you know, these teams are going out and they're sort of showing, you know, that maybe the owners aren't unified, or that's, you know, some owners aren't really in as dire straits as they say or whatever, I think the NHL isn't negotiating really from that position. I think they kind of put that out there, like, you know, oh, we have all these small market teams, we need to, they can't spend money. But I don't think the negotiations are really about that. I think the NHL sees an opportunity to reduce player costs. They see that the NFL and the NBA have both significantly reduced their player costs within the past year or two. And so there's a new standard. And I think the NHL sees that there's an opportunity for them to basically claw back what the players are making. And obviously the players' position is, basically, the CBA is working all right for us. Let's not rock the boat too much.
Well, you know what? I was actually kind of surprised when I heard that the players were actually offering to lower their percentage of league revenue. You know, because it seems to me that, I mean, Donald Fair requested all kinds of budgetary documents from the league, and he got them, very unlike the last lockout where the league refused to give more than four or five teams worth of information. But, you know, all of a sudden he looks at the document, says, you know, you guys aren't doing great. All right, fine. We'll cut back a little bit on player costs. But of course, you know, if the players budge a little bit on the first offer, that's not going to be enough for the league. I guess I'm starting to think, well, how much does the league really need?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about the players' offer, from what we know about it, is the idea of that fourth option year that reverts back to 57%, right?
Yeah.
Because this isn't, you know, my own analysis. I've seen other people write this, but the way the CBAs kind of work now in professional sports with a salary cap is that the owners basically every time come back and say, okay, we need a bit more, we need a bit more, we need a bit more. And so the starting point for negotiations is always lowering every CBA, right? Whereas by having that trigger year where it goes back to 57%, the next round of CBA talks starts at 57%, not 52 or 51 or whatever the NHL might want. So it's actually kind of a shrewd move on Fierce part, but it's for the same reason, it's something the NHL probably just wouldn't agree to.
Here's another question, bit of a shifting topic, but do you think that Donald Fair can manage to fold ownership in upon itself and make them, you know, sort of fight poor owners versus rich? Maybe not. Maybe there is a big sort of middle class of teams that are happy with whatever, but certainly, we're dealing with a pretty large disparity in terms of revenue. So do you think he can succeed in sort of turning the owners on themselves?
I'm actually surprised from what we know that they don't seem to have made more of an attempt to do that in the first pass. Obviously revenue sharing is kind of their go at that, and that's sort of what Donald Fair is familiar with from his baseball days. But one thing I'm really surprised they didn't offer is a lower cap floor, because then you're saying to smaller market teams, what you're saying is, okay, we understand that you're having some problems and you can't afford as much as the big markets, so why don't we just say you can spend less? And then the big markets that can afford to spend, you say, you know, you can spend obviously up to whatever the cap is. Because from the player's standpoint, all that really matters is the percent of HRR that they get, right? If it's 57%, they don't care if Toronto pays all of that or if Toronto pays 2% of that. Like, all that matters is that the players get that share, right? So it's not against the player's interest in any way to lower the floor, as long as the percent that they're entitled to overall stays the same. So I'm actually really surprised that the players didn't propose lowering the floor to try and take advantage of that, to sort of pit the small teams against the big teams and say, look, we're finding a way for the small teams to, you know, keep their head above water while the rich teams, you know, can sort of keep playing under the rules that are working for them.
I recently read Money Players by Bruce Daubing, which is a great book if you haven't read it, just for the pure content alone. And it went over the 1992 players' strike. And, you know, a lot of people hear about the 94-95 lockout, but not much is made of the 1992 players' strike. It was only something like 10 days long, and the owners folded faster than Superman on Laundry Day to give the players what they wanted, which, you know, admittedly was sort of a modest set of games, but they what the PA managed to do at that point under the recently appointed Bob Goodenow was basically to set the rich teams against the poor teams. At that time, there were a lot of relatively new expansion teams or teams with new arenas, right? So they needed to get back to playing because they needed to pay for these arenas. And on top of that, a lot of the big money teams needed to get back to playing because most of them were ready to make the playoffs and were sort of hungry for that cash. So the other thing that sort of pushed things along, I think, at that point was that the agreement expired on April 1st. So most of the way through the season, not long before the playoffs. Anyway, they managed to get the poorer owners or the smaller market teams. Well, either they were fighting with or working with the larger market teams to get back playing. Which is interesting. I really think that that's the key to Donald Fair's success as head of the union.
One of the interesting things to me is it would be really neat to know what kind of pressure the owners are putting on Bettman. Because we found out recently he makes, I think, about $8 million a year. He's got a fair bit of term left on his contract. You know, obviously he's in a pretty good position where, you know, Bettman himself has a lot of power in the negotiations apart from the owners. But you have to think Nashville wants a collective bargaining agreement pretty soon. They just paid Shea Weber $13 million. If the season is lost, they don't pay him $1 million. But once there's a new CBA, next summer they owe him $13 million again. Maybe not quite that much. It'll depend, you know, what the new CBA says. But, you know, based on what we know now, they'll owe him $13 million again. Do the Nashville Predators want to pay Shea Weber $26 million and have no revenues to pay that out of? I'm sure the Predators would like to see a season start as early as possible.
No kidding. And there are a lot of teams probably, too, that are banking on the NBC national television deal revenue, right? And that's going to be split up among, what, 23 teams? Okay, you know, maybe it's not going to be a huge, you know, a huge cash cow for them in terms of, like, the original payout. But I would have to think that it's also worth something to them as a marketing scheme, right? I mean, all this exposure is bound to be good for smaller market southern teams, right? So, you know, again, that's another thing that would probably put heat on the league to sort of fold by January.
And this is also kind of one of the reasons that I'm not quite so sure that a lot of people say that the small markets are sort of driving this and that what Bettman is doing is for the small markets. But people also talk about how the owners, you know, can afford to wait. But I feel like the owners who can afford to wait are you know, Bell and Rogers, you know, it's Ed Snyder and Comcast, all those kinds of things. But can the Panthers afford to lose whatever, you know, market share they'll lose if people don't watch hockey in Florida for a year? It might work out for them in that, sure, you know, they'll have to spend less money when they get back. But are they going to have lower revenues again? Because, you know, people in Florida just were like, well, okay, no hockey, whatever, I don't care. And then not come back, which I think is a real danger for small market teams where getting people into the buildings is already a problem.
I think that was one of the things I liked most about your article that you posted over at Pension Plan Puppets, is that it sort of highlighted the fact that the league actually didn't seem to be pandering to the smaller markets or trying to actually sort of nurture them, take care of them, and shelter them with the last CBA or with the proposed new one. It seems more like they're folding under the pressure of what the larger markets want to do. Well, I guess I don't know what the NHL's intentions are. Whose interests are they looking out for most? You know, if Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment Limited comes to Gary Bettman and says, look, dickhead, you need to get this sorted out by January, because if we lose the Winter Classic, you're in deep. You know, does that carry a lot of weight with him? I really don't know. Is a, you know, sort of a conglomerate of five teams who are really on the poorer end of things, smaller market teams, if five of them walk up to Gary Bettman and say, look, we need to get this sorted because of X, Y, and Z, you know, who does he listen to more? I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Elliot Friedman in his 30 Thoughts in his last one, he listed who was going to be at the initial CBA negotiations with Bettman. And obviously it was Daly and those people. But it was Brian Burke. It was, I think Craig Leopold is his name, the guy who owns the Wild. It was, I forget his name, the guy who owns the Bruins, I believe, was there. So if you look at the teams who are at the negotiating table, that's not the Panthers. You know, that's not Dallas. That's not Colorado.
Sure.
It's difficult to say for sure which teams are putting what kind of pressure on Bettman. But when the CBA negotiation team is Burke, and it's Leopold, and Jeremy Jacobs, I think, is the guy who owns the Bruins. Like, when it's those people who show up, like, I think that says something about what, about, you know, who actually has power in negotiations, or at least who is on side, because those guys aren't going to show up if they think what Bettman is going to do is going to ruin their finances.
It's sort of funny. I actually think that Burke maybe signifies the least out of all those guys, because, well, two reasons. One, Burke has always been a very obedient soldier when it comes to obeying not just the letter of the law of the CBA, but also the spirit of it, right? You know, refusing to sign these contracts with the long tail ends, blah, 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 blah. So, okay, I'm sure it's in Gary Bettman's good books for that. But on top of that, of course, Brian Burke was a league executive for years, right? On top of which, he was also a negotiator. He's a lawyer who specialized. He was a former agent, right? He's a guy who's a specialist in negotiations. He worked for the league. I'm sure has a lot of friends there. On top of which, has been very, very close to what you might call Bettman's vision for the CBA. So I guess I see him as a very useful right-hand man for Bettman. Maybe right-hand man is the wrong word, because of course that's Daly. But, you know, if you're going to walk into negotiations with somebody, I think Brian Burke is probably a man that Gary Bettman wants to keep close.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously they have a good working relationship from their time at the league. And Burke, perhaps to some degree, is a bit of an imposing figure at the negotiating table.
I would be scared witless.
if you're on the player's side. But, you know, people talk a lot about Burke's honor and that kind of thing. And I have to think that if MLSE said to Burke, "We don't want a lockout," I have to think that Burke would be there trying to prevent it. Like, yeah. I can't imagine he would just say to MLSE, you know, "No, that's not my vision of the league. I can't do that." Like, I think he's the kind of guy who would listen to ownership on an issue like that.
I think so, too. I think Michael Langlois at Vintage Leaf Memories brought up an interesting point. He said, you know, we've got these new owners, right? They're corporate owners. They're not in this because, you know, like Mr. Pegula, they're in it to win. They're in it to have a good time. They are in it to make money. I mean, if anything could make Bell and Rogers get along together, it would be to make money. Right, so you would have to think that these two companies would probably want to turn a profit on their investment in the first year of their ownership, right?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think that there's some pressure on them there to recoup some of that cost. But I think something that's interesting too is, like, Bell and Rogers and telecoms in general, they sort of play a long game with their finances, right? Like, one of the things that they do is they'll give you an expensive phone, either for free or at a significantly reduced cost, because over the course of the 3-year contract that you sign, they'll make that money back, right? And they do the same kind of thing. Like, if you call up your internet provider and you complain about your service and say you're going to quit, they'll offer you a better tier of service, you know, at no extra cost, you know, for a year. And they'll take whatever the hit is on that as the cost of keeping you as a customer, right? And so I think those companies, you know, Bell and Rogers, I think, are the kind of company that would go into a CBA with a long view, you know, given the way they run the rest of their businesses, saying, you know, viewing, you know, the CBA in a similar light. If this is a hit we have to take for this year to get our player situation fixed for the next, you know, 3 or 4 years or 8 years or whatever, you know, I've got to think that that's, given the way that those companies operate, I have to think that that's something that they would be willing to do.
Sure. I mean, you know, I have no doubt that these are companies with, you know, very capable financial teams, capable of, you know, calculating what the advantage would be to waiting a year versus starting the year late. I guess probably they've considered whether or not a lockout would be in the long term beneficial for them, and all that remains to be seen is whether or not they want one or not. And I don't know.
I think the general wisdom is that the reason that Bell and Rogers wanted the Leafs is for the TV rights. I mean, because those TV rights are worth a ton of money. Like, the article in McLean's I was talking about the CBC, one of the things that the guy from the CBC negotiator said was that their business plan was premised on the Leafs making the playoffs, and that they would lose money if the Leafs didn't make the playoffs, because the TV rights were worth that much. Like, the advertising they could sell by having the Leafs in the playoffs was just so astronomical. So I think Bell and Rogers are counting on a lot of that revenue, more for the regular season than the playoffs. But there are a lot of, like, regional games that they can control now, right? The ones that aren't on TSN or CBC. And so I don't know how much, you know, the Leafs' TV deals are set for the next year or two or whatever. but they stand to make a lot of money from that in the long run. So if they weren't going to make that much money from that angle this year, it might not be as big an issue to them as opposed to a couple of years down the line when they're able to run those games on their own networks and sell huge ad rates.
Hmm. That's a good point. All right, well, I tell you what, let's switch gears a little bit. Paul Ranger was recently acquired by the Leafs, and that puts the Marlies, actually, in a bit of a strange situation. I mean, it's not often that, the organization is forced to make a move because of an excess of veteran depth on their minor league team, but here we are. That seems to be the case. And on top of that, the Leafs have... Well, let's face it, way too many natural sediment. I mean, there's Grabowski, there's Bozak, Lombardi, who I think a lot of people forget is a centerman. Of course, there's Connolly, there's Steckel, there's McClement. Am I forgetting anybody? Well, of course, then there are youngins like Kadri, who could maybe make the jump. But anyway, where do you see the Leafs making their next move here?
I really feel like the trade market is kind of frozen up a bit on account of the CBA negotiations, because...
Sure.
Teams, they're re-signing their own players, but you're not seeing anything going on in the UFA market except a little bit of rumblings about Shane Doan. There haven't been any trades for a while. And so I think teams are really in a holding pattern. I almost wonder if there's a lot of stuff in the works that might sort of break in a row once the CBA situation is either resolved or is coming close to being resolved, once teams have some idea what their financial structure is going to be.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's anything coming anytime soon. I would be surprised if the Leafs made a move before, October, November, if that early.
I guess I don't anticipate anything soon, but between now and the beginning of the season, whenever that's going to be, God... help us. Let's hope it's, before January. But
let's say soon.
Yeah, let's hope. Anyway, I mean, Burke has come right out and said, look, we're not done. And I mean, we look at the roster and we say, yeah, you're not done. This isn't a playoff team. Moreover, you have more centers than you know what to do with. And, it's a Marlies roster that needs to be, it needs to be dealt with, for lack of a better. So, I mean... Okay, let's say for the sake of argument, that the season needed to start on, October 6th or whatever is normal. What would you anticipate the Leafs do with these centermen?
It seems to me as though the Leafs must be trying to move Lombardi and Connolly, if nothing else. I don't know if they just can't find any takers, or, maybe they're not trying to move them as hard as I think they are. Maybe they are planning on, they think the new CBA will let them put money in the minors. I don't think they would put Connolly in the NHL, but I think they probably would with Lombardi. So that might sort of free up that spot there. Although then you also have the problem of, sending more veterans to the AHL, right?
Right. Yeah.
Which is a bit of a problem for the Leafs already. So I have to think that Burke is working phones to try and find ways to get rid of those two guys. Because if you look at it right now, Grabowski is obviously the center of the second line, if we want to call it that. He said that McClement was brought in as a third-line center, and we know Steckel is kind of a third, fourth-line center. I think they probably could unload Steckel if they wanted to, but I think that would be a mistake. He's a cheap guy who plays his role well. They can't trade Bozak until they bring in another center, right? Like, that seems...
Potentially. I mean, Bozak and Connolly both have one more year on their deals. Maybe you take a gamble on Connolly, you keep him instead of Bozak. I sort of feel like Bozak could... move potentially if you keep one of the other two of Lombardi or Connolly, even though maybe they're not as cap efficient. It depends on what market there is for each one of those guys on the sort of the trade market. But one point I sort of made in the Maple Leafs annual is that the Leafs need to correct two things: shots against. I mean, they score enough goals right? I mean, that's not a big issue for them, especially with the addition of James Van Riemsdyk. But they need to reduce shots on goal and goals against. Now, shots on goal, they would probably need to completely revamp their defense, right? Because, it's a system of six or seven guys, and just replacing one cog in the wheel isn't going to make a big difference. If you're going to make one trade, and hopefully Burke will make more, but if you're going to make one, it's got to be for a goalie.
I mean, there's not much of a goalie market, right? It's basically Luongo at this point. And that stuff's kind of gone quiet too, I think, with all this CBA stuff going down.
I like to think that there's something else that we're not that we're not thinking of here, or that we're not privy to. I don't know.
Well, we know LA wants, or we know Bernier wants out of LA. It's not clear whether or not LA actually wants to move him, but he doesn't seem like a solution for the Leafs. He's basically another Reimer.
Yeah.
Or, you know, he has basically identical numbers to Reimer in
similar number of games. Yeah.
In fewer games on a better team, you know, behind Drew Doughty and Willie Mitchell. And, you know, so it's hard to see Bernier being what the Leafs need.
I don't know what the heck the Leafs are going to do with all these guys. The only thing that's certain is that Brian Burke needs to do a lot. Because, I mean, I think you and I can agree, this isn't a playoff team right now.
Not unless Reimer puts up, you know, 925 or whatever
numbers.
Again. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the defense is last year's defense minus Luke Shen. And Luke Shen didn't play well last year. But, you know, there's only so much addition by subtraction that you can do. I feel like the Leafs really need another top four defenseman, but I don't think that's one of Burke's priorities right now.
And I don't think Corbinian Holzer is going to do that. I don't think Ranger is going to do that either.
Well, I mean, Ranger can't play in the NHL.
Well,
even,
yeah,
right?
AHL
right?
contract,
they would have to. And I think it's possible that they sort of have an eye to do that if he... They may have just said, basically, we're running out of SPC slots. We'd love to give you a shot. And if it works out, we'll... you know, make something happen. But the Leafs don't have room to just be throwing contracts out when they still need Scrivens and Franzen under contract. So I think it's possible that they do sort of have a long-term view to getting Ranger in the lineup and just can't make it work until, you know, there's a roster slot, basically.
Not to mention the fact that Ranger is going to have to, you know, really get his legs back under him by playing in the AHL for a while. I mean, I wouldn't expect a guy who has taken a couple years off to just jump right back into the NHL. You know, even if he has kept up his conditioning, you know, your timing is going to be off. Your knowledge of systems is going to be a little less sharp. I mean, I remember when I played, you know, and I didn't even play junior, but, you know, even taking 2 days off or 3 days off, I noticed my reflexes just weren't quite sharp, you know, and they'd take a practice to come back, right? I can imagine taking 2 years off, I mean, it's going to take a while.
Especially the difference between rec league speed and NHL speed, right? I mean...
No kidding.
You know, there's a guy I work with who used to scrimmage with a couple of Senators players, and he would say, you know, even their like their lazy passes were like just flying off people's sticks, like people couldn't handle them. Like, you know, the speed at which they play the game is just, even a guy who's not that great is, you know, a poor NHL player is still really, really good at hockey for the most part.
You know what? Actually, it's funny. It's funny you mentioned that. I recently went to the tiny town, Lucan, Ontario, to go watch a charity game put on by Logan Couture and a bunch of other, you know, NHL, CHL, AHL stars, a couple NCAA guys there actually as well. And, you know, you could pick out the NHL guys easily. With the laziest looking wrist shot, they could send it just absolutely whipping across the crossbar. You know, it was actually kind of scary how easily they could do it. You know, it was with the slightest little flick, they seemed to be able to make the puck settle on their stick at impossible angles through any maze of sticks, legs, and bodies. It would land on a stick. Cross-ice passes that would come up to your waist would settle on someone's stick easily. And, you know, you could tell they were just fooling around. I mean, Drew Doughty was in the game, and he was playing center, for crying out loud. It wasn't like they were, you know, taking this that seriously. But it was remarkable how good they were, even with just the tiniest bit of effort.
I think we sometimes, like, you know, obviously the elite players in the NHL are really, really good. But I think we forget sometimes how good those other guys are. There was a game this year. I don't know if you remember it, if anyone listening will remember it. But Mike Brown got open, and he, like, Ovechkin'd a shot into the top corner. It was a laser beam. And it was Mike Brown, right?
Yeah.
Who has, you know, I don't know how many goals last year, probably like three or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, when he gets open, he can wire the puck just like, you know, Kessel or Ovechkin. But the thing is, playing against NHL defenders, it's hard for a guy like Mike Brown to get open enough to fire off a shot like that. But all those guys have that raw skill.
For sure. You know what? Actually, I think I was tweeting with James Myrtle, and he was saying that at practice one day, I think it was Mike Komisarek, not known for his hands, and I want to say it was like Carl Gunnarsson or something. And they were having a competition between themselves at practice, and they were seeing who would miss the crossbar first. And they kept backing up each time they did it. And he said they must have hit the crossbar, you know, like 50 times or something like that. Okay, maybe they didn't back up each time they did it, whatever. I don't know. But, you know, they took turns basically pegging a 3 or 4 inch piece of iron, and they did it every single time for, you know, 30 times in succession, or whatever it was. You know, these guys that we consider to be ham-handed are still pretty remarkably talented.
Yeah, I've got it here. Mike Brown had 2 goals in 50 games last year.
Oh, there you go.
So he's not a high-end goal scorer, to say the least. But you know, if you give him room, he's got a good shot. All of, you know, everyone has a good shot at that level. It's just some guys are better at actually getting in position to fire one off.
Sure.
So yeah, so as to Paul Ranger, I think it's going to take some time for him to get back at even AHL speed, probably, let alone NHL speed.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, well, listen, Adam, thanks for coming on the show. I think we're going to cap it there for now. But yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been good. Have a good evening yourself.
Right on. Thanks a lot. You too.
All right, cheers.
All right, bye-bye.